Peter Matheson is here. He is an acclaimed novelist for 30 years. He is obsessed over the mysterious life and death of his character, Edgar J. Watson. He produced three novels from different points of view, chronicling why Watson was murdered. They are Killing Mr. Watson, they are Lost Man's River, and they are Bone by Bone, all by Peter. His new book is called Shadow Country. It is a new rendering of his three previous novels about E.J. Watson. I am pleased to have Peter Matheson back at this table. And we have a lot of explaining to do here. First of all, who is E.J. Watson, this new novelist? Who is he? And how did you discover him? And was he the meanest, toughest man you ever knew of?
I wish I had known him. I discovered him thanks to my father. Yeah. We were going up the west coast of Florida on a boat a long time ago when I was about 17. And he showed me Chatham River on the chart. Right. And he said, there's a house up there, and it's the only house in the Everglades. Right. And the guy who owned it was a guy named Watson, who was blown away right. by his neighbors, 33 bullets worth. He didn't really know much more about it than that, yeah. but it stuck in my brain. I wanted to write about the Everglades, his environment as American Indian territory. All that fascinated me. And Watson was kind of the thread of a story. But nobody knew anything about him. There's a lot written about him. It was all wrong. It was all myth, legend, and very much exaggerated. And I started looking into the darn thing, and I got absolutely fascinated.
Because? What was fascinating
about him? Because his reputation was that he was a killer.
Right.
And he apparently had killed about 50 people. This, of course, was absolute nonsense. But even
he never killed anybody?
Oh, I couldn't separate him from about seven. There were about seven deaths, that I think. But he wasn't a serial killer or anything like that. And he was a very, very able man. A genius as a planter, a sugarcane planter, an entrepreneur and boatman and everything. He drank a lot too much, and he had a terrible temper. And he came from, as I discovered, which nobody had found out about, yeah. he didn't just live in Southwest Florida. He was born in South Carolina, Edgefield County, the most violent county in American history, although it produced many, many South Carolina governors. And his father was called Elijah Watson, and his nickname was Ring Eye Lige. And the reason he was called Ring Eye Lige is because he got in one of his many saloon brawls, and somebody got him down and incised this big ring around his eye, which was the final disgrace to his family. Anyway, he beat up his wife, he beat his kids, and Edgar fled. And he just had a very, very bad beginning. And ended up in Oklahoma. He's supposed to be the man that killed Belle Starr, who was murdered in 1889 out there. And then he went to Arkansas prison for horse theft. And they said he tried to escape and was killed. But he wasn't killed. He got back to Florida. And there he began this very, very colorful career. But he was a friend of Napoleon Broward, who became right. governor.
Right.
His daughter was married to the president of the Fort Myers National Bank.
Right.
All this is true. But the family wouldn't talk about him. When I began to get interested, I could have...
The family wouldn't talk about him because?
In those days, if your dad was shot with 33 bullets yeah. and blown right. away, he was what's called a shadow cousin.
Right.
That's part of the title, the Shadow Country,
the Shadow Cousin.
You know, American Indian people, they say, we're your shadow brothers. And actually, black people will say the same thing. We're the people you keep in the shadows, and they are a big shadow over our country. And racism is kind of the underlying
theme okay.
of it.
So you've said that when were these books published? I mean, when was Killing Mr. Watson and Bone by Bone and Lost Man's River published?
They all came out in the 90s. I think the first one was in 1990, Killing yeah. Mr. Watson. But the thing was, when I turned it in, Charlie, it was huge. It was
2,000 pages, I think.
It was about 2,000 pages. And, of course, my editor, Jason Epstein.
Said, are you nuts?
Well, they thought I was nuts. But we decided.
Did you actually think this was going to be one novel?
It was one novel.
I know that, but did you actually think they were going to publish it?
I didn't have much hopes, to be true.
I've just never understood why you would walk in there and say, here's my novel, it's 2,000 pages, and go publish it.
I didn't really say that at all. I said, this is what it's going to be, and it's going to be called Killing Mr. Watson. That was the title for the whole book.
Well, did you pay any attention to how long it was?
Well, really, that, in a sense, wasn't my concern. That was their concern. Well, we straightened it out. We pulled it apart.
And made it. So what is this?
When it was pulled apart, it didn't. The pieces, some of it worked, but for me, it wasn't.
It was one work for you.
It was one work for me, and then when it came out and it was, you know, very kindly received, it was too long, and in making it three, I had to warp the middle book especially. It just needed a lot of cutting, and I wanted to really tighten it. I wanted to go in deeper, and also Watson had not let go of me. He fascinated me.
What is that? He
I don't know. People in the beginning said, why are you so interested in a man like that? I was interested because, first of all, he was so complex and so various, and people liked him. He had three wives who adored him. Many other ladies liked him, too. He had children all over the place.
Yes.
He was a great storyteller. Apparently, that was true. He was, and he loved his kids. He did. He was very good with his kids. But he also had this very, very dangerous side. Now, I was free as a novelist to do, in a sense, what I wanted with him, because the fact that
where's your literary license in all this?
Well, my literary license, just to make it more fun for me, I think I gave him a lot of humor. It's a pretty pretty Morden black humor, that is true, but he is funny, and he was supposed to be. And I wanted people, against their own will, to like him. And I was absolutely thrilled that a few of the reviews, Bone by Bone was written in his voice, and that's more or less intact in this book.
Right.
And people, some of the reviewers said, you know, we must be sick. We really like that.
Yeah. But that's what you wanted.
That's what I wanted.
But they say that in the movies, they always say that what you have to do is find some humanity in a bad character.
Absolutely.
Something that people are really interested in and don't just dismiss him or her.
Yeah.
All right, so you set out to do this, to put it all together.
Yeah.
Now, how long a task was that?
It was supposed to be a year. I was going to just put them back together like Humpty Dumpty, but I'm sorry to say it took 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. It is your obsession, fair to say? Watson is the central creative character.
I worked on, you know, I'm working on all my life. I've worked on the environment. I've worked on race problems, social justice, all those things.
Right.
That's all in there. There's some very dark stuff in there. I think it's my, it brings together everything I ever did.
Yeah.
The risk is, Charlie, that people will think they read it already. They haven't. It's a very different book. And that's going to be hard to sell to the public.
Well, we're here to say that.
Yeah, that's good.
This is a new and different book.
Yes, exactly.
If you read this...
Yeah. Go for it.
Exactly. If you read this 18 years ago, you know, it's time to read some of it. Because Peter has had an editor's head at this.
I cut 400 pages. That's a pretty good
exactly.
Story. Right.
We're still 800.
Right. Cheaper the price.
Yes, indeed. There is also this... Some people say this is Peter's reach for the great American novel.
Every novel is the author's reach for the great American novel. That is not a crime.
It's not a crime.
It is an ambitious book. It is.
Yeah, it is. Ambitious in what way?
It's very difficult.
Because it tells an American...
It's an unpleasant story.
Yeah.
It's also a great story, but we are a great and terrible nation, and this has got both of it in there. So it's not a pretty story. But I think... It's on the money. I think it's truthful, and I think I've gone pretty deep with it. It's awful to blow my own horn that way.
You should blow your horn.
I've been on it for 30 years. If I haven't pulled it off by now, it's...
Just listen to what this man has done. Race rock partisans, Ratazer, at play in the fields of the Lord, for Tortuga, on the River Styx, and other stories, killing Mr. Watson, Lost Man's River, Bone by Bone. Fiction. Nonfiction. Wildlife in America, the cloud forest under the mountain wall, Salsipuedes. The wind birds, blue meridian, the trees where a man was born, and this one, the snow leopard. That's everybody knows you best about that, don't they?
I think they do.
All right.
Yeah.
Sand rivers in a country, in the spirit of Crazy Horse, Indian country. Where does this come from, this sort of obsession you have about endangered species, about beautiful creatures, about the environment and all of that?
I think I just hate to see so much lost. We are battering our country, and it is a beautiful country and a great country of such potential greatness, and yet we have not solved our race problems.
Right.
And I worked a lot with Cesar Chavez and American Indian people. Black people are really the underlying theme here, and that one of the hero in here really is not Watson. It's a man named Henry Short, who's a black guy. And he's the one who apparently, and actually in the rumor, but maybe truthfully, is the first guy who shot other mob that met him to was the first one to shoot, and nothing else was needed. He was the only guy by reputation who could outshoot Watson. And people wanted him there, and they overcame their racism. They said, what's a black guy shouldn't be in a crowd holding a gun up to a white man. He killed anybody who, in a way, upset him, especially when he was drinking.
Well, that's a nice quality, isn't it? And if I'm drinking and I'm upset with you, I'm going to kill him.
I'm upset with you, and do you want your pay or don't you?
That was about that, too. He would kill him because
Watson
they wanted his
payday.
Pay.
It's called Watson Payday. That was a rumor. I don't see much foundation for that in mind, but it could have been. It could have been.
Was he supposed to be a good-looking man?
Yes, he was. Oh, yes, he was very good-looking.
You start in the book, you acknowledge what happened to him.
Yes, in the first pages.
Exactly.
I'm not interested in the plot.
Right.
That's the least interesting thing. How did it happen? How does this come about that a guy is killed by people who are not killers or thugs or outlaws?
Right.
They are farmers and fishermen, and they get together and they wipe out this man. Now, some say it was a lynching. Others say, no, he raised the gun first. It was self-defense. They're still fighting that one out down there.
So what say Peter?
I'm... In a way,
I'm agnostic about this.
No, you see, I follow Watson right from his boyhood, right till the moment he makes his decision to go in and meet that crowd. He makes it consciously. And my own instinct is he knew he'd had it. He couldn't play his cards out any further. I think he knew, but he still tried to bluff me. He tried to get away again because he'd done it many times.
Yeah.
And he was... I think the community exploded. There'd been a hurricane. Their morale was terrible. They were all dirty. They were starving. They didn't have any water. They didn't have anything. And then this terror happens, and murders were happening on his plantation.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even there. He did have a certifiable natural-born killer working for him. That was bad. A guy called Leslie Cox, who actually was his nephew-in-law or something. Cox was very bad. But Cox killed these people. And the whole community, you can't blame them. It's too much.
Been a movie about him?
A lot of people sort of fiddled around with
the idea. There's stories like that. The Watson guy, I knew that. I knew that was the answer.
Yeah.
I have more people that know it's some great story they're willing to tell. But why haven't you wanted to tell this story as a film?
As a film.
Oh, maybe we will now with Shadow Country.
Maybe, but Killing Mr. Watson was option. Bone by Bone was option.
Oh, right, they're all option. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all...
And then they can't get around to figuring out how to make it.
Well, you know,
even if he had a redeeming
quality. It's awful big. Remember, At Play in the Fields of the Lord, my novel, was made into a movie.
Right.
And very ambitiously and very well, really. But they tried to do the whole thing. It was too big a story to get in an hour and a half. So they made a great five-hour movie.
Well, you put it on...
So,
HBO.
But somehow that didn't
occur to them.
Whoever did this has to choose a piece of it.
Yeah, or be choose a different forum for it.
A different forum, a miniseries.
A miniseries, something like that.
Yeah.
You mentioned you were talking about George last night.
Yeah.
You and George worked together, Paris Review.
That's right.
Founded the Paris Review.
Yeah.
And who else founded the Paris Review?
There's a guy called Doc Humes, whose novels, by the way, are being reissued this year by Random House. And Doc was a very, very talented, very, very bright guy.
Tell me about Doc Humes.
Doc Humes was a guy who worked for the government over there, the ECA, I think, but he also started a little magazine called the Paris News Post. And I was over there writing my first novel. He wanted me to come in and get fiction for him, for his little magazine. And I got the first story I got for him was about a guy called Terry Southern.
Terry,
iconic.
So you got Terry. Terry to write for
him. Yeah. And then I thought this Doc's magazine was a little entertainment magazine, like the old Q magazine, something like that. And I thought this stuff is too good for this magazine. I said to Doc, let's start a real literary magazine. Mm-hmm. But then, and also his magazine was falling apart from under him. He was enormously bright, but he couldn't work with anybody. And I very soon found out why in trying to get him going with the Paris Review. I realized it was impossible. So I knew George. We were schoolmates at the age of 8. So I knew he, and I knew he was in England. He was at Cambridge, and more or less at loose ends. And I got hold of him. I said, how'd you like to come over here and run a little magazine? Because I knew otherwise it was going to go down through. And he said, sure. And he came, and that was it. And George really became the Paris Review. He wasn't he was technically not the founder, but he was sure the editor.
Why did he become the Paris Review? I mean, what was it about his skills? Was it
Everything. He loved the Paris Review. At the end of it, he said, this is the great love of my life. At the end of his life, he said that.
It's amazing to me that way. Bill Buckley said at the end of his life, National Review was a great love of his life.
Well.
It's what he's most proud of.
Really, yeah.
I mean, you could disagree with the National Review, which you clearly do. But, I mean, you can admire somebody who... What? Come on. Peter.
My politics are...
I know, but you can admire somebody whose politics are different and love magazines and love writing.
I knew Bill very well.
I know. Yeah. I know you do. There's now a documentary about Doc.
Yes, there is.
You're in it.
I know I'm in it. Not in the way I particularly like.
Why not?
Well, it's because it touches on something I've never denied, but it was a part of my youthful folly, which was that I went there as a CIA agent in Paris.
So you were a CIA agent who used the Paris Review as cover.
I invented the Paris Review as cover.
Exactly.
Yeah. I did, but in very, very short order. I was much more interested in the Paris Review than I was in my paid job, so to speak. You know, Charlie, I've been very lucky in my life. I've had many really great adventures. This is the only adventure I regret, was the CIA. But it did do one thing for me. And I quit, you know, on the job over there. When I was still a young kid, I was only 24, 25.
So what, you were 2 years in the CIA?
Yeah, it was 2 years. And then I realized my politics, I never had any politics before. I was a greenhorn, you know. And my politics, when I got them, were way left of there. And I told my...
Handler or whatever.
You know, you guys really can't trust me anymore. I'm not on your side. You know, things are happening back here. A lot of bad stuff, blacklists and all the witch hunts.
So what would you do for them in Paris?
Well, I think we'll just have to go to the rest of the show. It wasn't very much. It was pretty paltry, really. What it really was doing, you know what I was doing? Spending my day doing? Deceiving people. That's all it is.
Deceiving people as to...
As to who you are, your identity, what you're up to, what you want to know to them about, all that kind of stuff. I really disliked it.
But were you looking for people you can convert to, or were you looking to expose people?
I was getting information on people. I didn't even know what I was doing because they never tell you what the heck you're doing is what they're using it for. But I made a very good contact. They were very excited about it. And it was at that point it came to kind of a head. They wanted me to go in deeper and make myself kind of a dupe, a tool for the...
Writing for you.
Yeah.
Are you happiest with nonfiction or fiction?
Fiction.
You are.
I began as a fiction writer. That's all I wrote for 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's where my real heart is. I mean, I love fiction. I wrote nonfiction to make a living. I'm not putting it down. And as somebody pointed out to me, my nonfiction, in a way, it's the same themes. You know, really it is. It's an elegiac.
Right.
The loss of values and the loss and injustice. And so, in a way, I'm writing about the same thing. But fiction, you can go much deeper. I use the word for this thing. I'm distilling it. I'm going deeper and deeper. You can just do things you can't do. In nonfiction, you're stuck with the facts, aren't you? Or you should be. You should be more or less loyal to the facts.
You should be.
You should be.
You should be in nonfiction more or less loyal to the facts?
There are a lot of people who aren't very loyal to the facts, and you know it perfectly well.
Of course I do.
In fiction, you go to a much deeper place.
Speaking of writing nonfiction and fiction, you have always been obsessed, maybe, about endangered species.
Yeah.
An endangered planet.
And endangered peoples.
And endangered peoples. Yeah, absolutely. Native American.
Yeah.
Is there something about the American ideal that you think is endangered? Yeah.
I think so. I think what we're settling for, really, in recent years, in recent decades, is so far a degraded form of what was originally envisaged in the Constitution and our founding fathers and everything. And there's an ignoble quality. It seems to me we're constantly going in and beating up on, and usually darker people, some small country, whether it's, you know, Haiti or Grenada or Vietnam or wherever. It seems to me we're behaving in a way to go into Iraq, putting the whole thing about Iraq aside. I mean, the question, the dispute, But to say shock and awe and to announce we are going to go in and shock and awe these people with our might and our bombs, even no matter how justified the maneuver was, which is debatable, that seems to me beneath our dignity as Americans, to go in there and frighten people like that. Imagine people. And Abu Ghraib, the whole thing, I think, is just beneath this terminal rendition, always mysterious, dreadful terms that we use now, as if this is perfectly normal behavior, torture, and all this.
Do you think it's a temporary thing in the American experience that...
I sure hope so. I sure hope so. I think we've lost, and we've lost a lot of respect around the world, and rightly so, rightly so. And I think, you know, as Americans, when we really feel, well, this is a fantastic country, a great, great country, I think, and I think we have to speak out. It's not unpatriotic to say, hey, we are better than this. We're better people than this. Our values are better than this. And that's the way I feel. I'm going to kick and scream to the end, you know.
You think about the end?
Well, you know, I'm 81. I mean, time is not on my side. But however...
We never know.
Yes. We never know, but I do have a lot of things to finish.
Yeah. But have you thought about it? I mean, have you thought about... You know, you do think about your legacy. And, you know, I mean, I think this is part of it. I really do. I think you want to get this out there because
I do,
this
because
was
I
a life's work.
That's a 30-year job one way or the other.
Yeah. Praise for Peter Matheson and his books of the Watson Trilogy. I'll choose our friend Richard Ford. The fiction of Peter Matheson is the reason a lot of people in my generation decided to be writers. No doubt about it. Shattered Country lives up to anyone's highest expectations for great writing. And then you go down to Saul Bellow, the late Saul Bellow. Some people consider one of the finest American writers. People
Martin
Amis and others.
Yeah.
I read Bone by Bone with admiration and pleasure. The conquest of the continent is completed in the Southeast by strange characters.
Anarchic.
And almost always out of control. You know this by heart, don't you? Who, however, remain curiously coherent. The language is wonderful, very different from the descriptions of pioneering we have become accustomed to. A great advance on Walt Whitman or even Robert Frost. I mean, it just goes on and on, doesn't it?
Well, let's hope.
Let's hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Charlie. Great to see you.